if any of your listeners get uncomfortable with these ideas, remember that speculative element and just put a what if in front of everything. You don't have to adopt my position that oil, coal, and gas is sentient or that it is trying to cause climate change. But what if it was? If it was sentient, if it was trying to achieve this end, it could do no better than it actually did.
Hi, everyone. Today, I had the pleasure of connecting with Jed Bickman. He's an imaginative writer based out of Oakland, California. He's known for his intriguing series on Substack known as The Spouter. Today, we delve into Jed's unique perspective on speculative philosophy. His thought-provoking exploration surrounds itself on the concept of sentient oil, an all-encompassing alien-like force that he argues acts on humanity, and this central node is which his work develops on. Viewed through a Marxist lens, his writing presents an unconventional narrative on petroleum's rich role in shaping contemporary history and mind. Ultimately, Jed's efforts are an attempt to radicalize the climate discourse. We explore hyperstition, cybernetics, his love of typewriters, analog technology, the role of speculation in philosophy, gravity's rainbow, cyclopedia, and his concept of getting noided, among other interesting topics. As Jed holds speculative lens, get noided, as Jed invites. Thanks for being here.
So Jed, tell me about your typewriter thing. What is that about?
Yeah, well, my writing life is there so that I've got an excuse to use my typewriters. Really enjoy the typing experience. I had the opportunity when a couple years ago to sort of intern at a really storied typewriter repair shop. That's actually, it's the one that's featured in the movie California Typewriter. So since then, I've been keeping a lookout for busted up cheap typewriters that I can restore and repair. It's something that's fun. I don't have so much time to do it as much anymore, but
Who is using typewriters right now? I'm just curious. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I'd say it's largely people like me who are sort of into analog technology. I like it because it really frees up my writing because there's no delete key. And so I'm not editing myself while I'm writing. And of course, I go back and edit it. I type it into the computer and that gives me a chance to edit it. And I often do that like many times. And so it works well with my writing process. And other people, I wouldn't say hipsters because not everybody is like cool who's into typewriters, but people who have that sort of like pro analog sensibility.
Do you find that kind of accelerating now with technology just as a parallel? Do you think people
Yeah, definitely. Typewriters got a huge boom with COVID in 2020. A lot of people got into typewriters, which showed like, you know, a sort of pent up interest that people hadn't had time to explore. A lot of people are, you know, they're not looking to do their hobby on the computer. Like my day job is on the computer as many other people's. So it's like staring at a screen all day. And you don't really want to come home and do more of that.
And then, Jen, my last question about typewriters, are there still manufacturers of typewriters going strong or what's
the... No, it's all the used market. There does exist new typewriters that are being built that you can buy at like Michael's, but I would strongly, strongly recommend against doing that. They're really garbage. The know-how, the technical know-how, the factories, they just don't exist anymore.
So Jed, maybe we can start there since we're already chatting.
Yeah.
Tell me about what you're writing about, maybe your day job a little bit or where you're coming from. And then maybe just we can branch off of your maybe love of typewriters being a branching point for your interaction with technology and ideas and some of the radical things you're writing about.
Yeah, sure. Well, my writing, I feel like, is so unrelated to my actual life that I'm having trouble forming a bridge there because it's something that like I was looking for a project, I guess, in 2020 was a writer for a long time, and I have a degree in like nonfiction writing, and I'm always interested in experimental like literary nonfiction. I took a long break from writing. Well, for the first sort of 5 years of my son's life, since he's autistic, those years were very intense and sort of heads down and a constant crisis. And then, you know, we got to 2020, you know, it was still difficult with him, but with the pandemic circumstances at my job where the company, you know, had to shift business models, and that gave me like some extra time. So I was really just looking for a project, and I had been really taken with Cyclonopedia when it came out, or when I first saw it, which was a couple of years after it came out, I think, and decided to sort of start there, but to do it differently than Cyclonopedia. So that book is very heavily sort of like theory fiction with the emphasis on the theory. Like most people find it very dense, but the core principles of sort of speculative materialism, I thought that I could go back and apply those to actual American history. And, you know,
Jed, just interrupt, could you give me just a framework for listeners, because I wasn't familiar with Cyclonopedia before. I was familiar with some of the cybernetic thinkers, but not Negrestani. So maybe you can just give us a framework for how you approached him, and where did you first discover him and his writing?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I guess I was just really lucky that I had a roommate who was descending into schizophrenia at the time and spending his time sort of looking online for interesting ideas and interesting books. And he came across Cyclonopedia. Negrestani, when I picked up the book, I thought that Negrestani was a pen name or a fictional character because, first of all, he presents himself that way in the book. And also, it seems sort of too perfect that he was writing from Tehran or writing from Iran, but he actually was and was a real person writing from Iran. And he subsequently immigrated to the US. And so I had the chance to meet him. But the problem was that by the time Cyclonopedia was published, but certainly by the time he came to the US, he really regarded it as sort of a foolish early effort and made a sort of radical U-turn, still within philosophy, really working on the sort of classical liberal frameworks of philosophy, where subjectivity is treated as sort of a uniquely human experience, which is very different than Cyclonopedia. Quickly for your reader, for your listeners, Cyclonopedia sort of posits that the Middle East itself is a sentient entity. And of course, as it is a site of vast petroleum reserves, a part of that sentience is expressed in oil. He, as you say, is sort of a part of the overall speculative materialist movement. I think that there's a lot of red flags to see in the subsequent careers of the people who were, you know, most associated with that movement, particularly Nick Land, who sort of became a darling of the alt-right. Any sort of theoretical movement that allows one to move in that direction, to me, is inherently suspect as a Marxist. However, at the time, you know, I didn't know that that was going to happen. I was really attracted both by the speculative aspect of it and the materialist aspect of it. The speculative aspect of it allows us to sort of dispense with all of the philosophy that justifies the question of whether an object can be sentient, or including oil. And it just lets us say, what if? So speculative materialism is to philosophy sort of what science fiction is to regular fiction. It allows you to start with a radical premise that doesn't need to be justified, a big what if that's sort of implied in the text. And then it allows you to toy with that, with those ideas. And applying that to materialism was very compelling to me as a Marxist. Obviously, Marxism is expressed through dialectical materialism. And it's really fascinating to me that none of the sort of original speculative materialists worked in the Marxist tradition. And so I think that that's a very fruitful area for further study. I don't see anything inherently contradictory between speculative materialism and historical materialism. In fact, I see a great compatibility. And I think that it was a missed opportunity that those thinkers didn't take that route.
So tell me about your roommate and his experience in schizophrenia, because I think you write about, and also the cybernetic thinkers write a lot about, the schizoid mental state of contemporary thought.
Yeah.
So I don't know if there's any parallels there. Or
I mean, I would caution against it. Actually, my day job is in mental health and psychology. I edit books on psychology and mental health, self-help books. And the experience of schizophrenia, I've had two very close friends, you know, including the one that we mentioned, who have had, you know, severe psychotic breaks and been diagnosed with either schizoaffective disorder, schizophrenia. Schizoaffective sounds less mild than schizophrenia, but in fact, it's more severe since it's accompanied by a mania. Those conditions are extremely painful. It's not fun to hear voices. And it's not, once the psychosis really gains momentum, there is almost no intellectual value in it. It really is a disorder or a disease. But at the same time, you know, we were all interested, including me, interested in Deleuze, who sort of says that he's doing a schizoanalysis of capitalism. And so within that sort of theoretical rubric, schizophrenia really signifies the schism. It's a reality breaking apart, but that is closely associated with its opposite, paranoia, which is also certainly a symptom of schizophrenia as a disease. Paranoia is the belief that is the seeing of things as connected, as coming together. So it's at once a shattering of the world and a deep understanding of how everything is connected beneath the shattering. I'm compelled by Deleuze. I think that his anti-Oedipus really gives a good understanding of the flows of society, not only capital, but of material through the engine of society. And that's something that I see Nigar Astani is taking up as well in Psychonopedia.
Could you expand just a little bit more on how you think that, we haven't got to your thesis yet on what you're writing about. So maybe how those two elements feed into your kind of concept of sentient oil and whatnot.
Well, I think the sentient oil it's a paranoid idea. The idea that we are sort of being controlled by a literally subterranean force that is actually much bigger and more powerful than a human. You know, we're used to thinking of objects as less powerful and sort of inert and therefore less powerful than humans. But in oil, we have a subterranean force that is vastly and incomprehensibly more powerful than humans, since it's made up of the biomass of the, you know, accumulated energy of eons that have been buried. So it's an encounter with what Timothy Morton might call a hyper object, an object that is so much larger than humanity that we actually have trouble grasping it within our human realms. And it connects everything. You know, we also say, I thought that Timothy Morton said this, but neither he nor I can find where he said it, but that modernity is the process of oil getting into everything, that it is something, it's a common ingredient in almost everything in our physical built environment and in our economy and in our emotional lives. And so in that sense, it's a paranoid force that has nonetheless shattered reality. And when I say that, you know, I mean that its effects are obviously schizoid in the way that Deleuze called capitalism schizoid. It creates fragments, a fragmentary culture, which I think you can see very clearly on the internet, where we're all sort of split into very narrow groupings of sort of common interests. We're erecting new barriers in between each other. And yet we are all subject to these unifying sort of paranoid forces. So there's a simultaneous schizing and paranoiaing of everything that I think is interestingly the common ingredient is not just oil, of course, but oil, coal, and gas, those petrol forces.
Going just up a little bit to the hyper object that you just described, I was listening to an interview with Nick Land, and he was describing capitalism as one of those hyper objects that's just, quoted Mao's quote, that it mushrooms out. There's nothing you can do to stop it from just continuing to mushroom. What is Nigar Astani's political viewpoint, or is he a Marxist?
I would say that for he, if you look at sort of what he's doing now in his second book, I think it's clear that he's like a liberal. which to me is not quite as objectionable as, you know, Nick Land's direction, but it's still not at all what I'm interested in. I think that he has a mind that was very turned on by the complexity, intellectual artistry that was on display in the CCRU and that, you know, Nick Land is capable of, let his mind go down those paths. I think that his political experience is very based on his political beliefs are probably very influenced by his actual historical circumstance of growing up within an Islamist theocracy and sort of rebelling against that and distancing himself from that, which is a very different political context that I'm coming from as an American growing up within a liberal context and rebelling against that. And so I totally forgive him for his beliefs, but it's...
No, I was just curious how you're seeing the parallel, because I see, capitalism as a hyper object and as a metaphor for oil itself, as they're both these forces that you're describing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that oil is inseparable from capitalism. I like to encourage people to think of capitalism as an AI, a sort of program that is put upon humans and sort of run on us that overrides our free will. You know, in Marx, he talks about how the capitalist has no free will because he's moving only in according to the logic of capital. And I think that once industrialization really gets going, that is inseparable in a fundamental way from capitalism. Of course, there were capitalist forms that preceded industry. The beast that we now understand as capitalism was radically and vastly accelerated by oil, coal, and gas. And there is a clear transformation that takes place. Of course, if you're looking closely at the oil industry, which I do in a historical context, there's the constant flow of the material into the capital. So they're converting constantly the oil into the capital and redeploying the capital to create more of the material and so on. And of course, that's going on throughout the capitalist economy. You know, I totally agree with Nick Land in this narrow instance where he's talking about capitalism as a hyper object or as an AI. I'm just pointing out that it has a material component in sort of runs parallel but opposite the flows of capital itself.
Jed, could you walk us just for a little bit, for people who might not be familiar with the CCRU, what it is, its history? I mean, it has so many ideas. It's almost...
Yeah. I can a little bit. It's not really something that I'm an expert in, but it was basically an online gathering place in the sort of late 90s, early 2000s that attracted thinkers from around the world, the sort of main figures that are associated with it, or Ray Brassier, and then Nick Land, who we've talked about, and Mark Fisher. And they were really interested in this idea of hyperstition, which is the idea that you can write something into reality. So they would take an idea that would be considered speculative, like sentient oil, and create a hyperstitional framework in which they would theorize it as if it was true. And in that sort of, they believed, sort of recreate it into reality. It's a very hyper sort of online, very early internet type of milieu. I would caution people about getting too into it again, because I think that they can present a sort of false radicalism. Their writing is so complex and magnetic and compelling that you sort of think that they're offering a radical critique of capitalism. In truth, they're sort of finding what they think of as a third way sort of between fascism and communism, allows them to really reify the existing power structures. But that said, I really think that there were brilliant people involved in it. And I love that type of writing that is so complex that you can spend, you know, 5 hours on one page or one post or one paragraph and untangle it and get something out of it. And I think that a lot of that writing does rise to that level. I really appreciate that, and haven't found that in many other places outside of Thomas Pynchon.
What's interesting, Jed, to me is so many of their theories have, I don't know, hyperstitioned past tense, but it become used by people. Like I said in my other interview with this Arx Khan, he's all talking about accelerationism. There's left accelerationism, zero accelerationism, right accelerationism.
Yeah.
And I'm curious how, going back to your writing about sentient oil and speculative, you know, philosophy and materialism, tell me, go back to your main thesis on sentient oil, just as a framework for how can people who aren't so philosophical use this as a way to understand the world and understand history or understand what's happening?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. One avenue I like to take into this, and it, because this really was an avenue that I took into it, was working to understand and re-theorize global warming. I think that it's the sort of mainstream treatment of this topic has been really narrow and disappointing, where on the one side, you, of course, have the denialists. And then on the other side, you have a very sort of scientific and scientistic apparatus that is funded to narrowly counter the denialists and sort of assert the quote unquote reality of global warming. And in doing so, they've adopted the stance that global warming is deeply associated with being human, that it is humans' fault, and that it is a product of humanity, because the denialists in turn have argued that, like, oh, maybe it's happening a little bit, but it's not, you know, the fault of our industry. And so that's placed sort of the liberals in this position where they're closely associating climate change, which I would argue is another hyper object that's much larger than us as humans. They're deeply associating that and calling it anthropogenic climate change. But if you break it down, so what is actually happening is that we are releasing carbon into the atmosphere. That carbon is then creating climate change. So it's not that humans don't have any role in that picture, but that the proximate cause of climate change is deeply inhuman, anti-human, ancient force that is emerging from within the earth to occupy and colonize our atmosphere. And so once we can understand that, I think we can begin to put some space between humanity as a sort of animal species with bodies and, you know, loves and needs and culture. We can put some space between that and industrial capitalism, which is larger than human, anti-human, working against our interests. And to me, that orients us politically against the right targets. You know, we stop blaming overpopulation because we recognize that it's not human bodies that cause climate change, but rather machines that are burning oil, coal, and gas. You don't have to adopt my position that oil, coal, and gas is sentient or that it is trying to cause climate change. But what if it was? If oil, coal, and gas, if the end goal of oil, coal, and gas was to escape from underground, somehow be freed from its subterranean lair and emerge out not only into the surface, but above the surface into the atmosphere in order to, say, for example, recreate the climate from when it was last alive, from the Carboniferous period, when the earth was much warmer, the seas were much higher. If that was its end goal, would history have looked any different than it actually did? And the answer is actually no. It's as if the 20th century was the process of creating a machine to burn oil, a machine that guaranteed the constant flow of oil out of the ground and up into the atmosphere. If it was sentient, if it was trying to achieve this end, it could do no better than it actually did.
So, Jed, going back a step, how do you see the different narrative? How are they being controlled by these thoughts, these hyper objects? I mean, to me, the cybernetic movement is the problem, like with Nick Land, is it goes down to this, how do you control people? That's what they're really interested in. So how, you know, maybe you can riff on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think the cybernetic movement, and, you know, the cybernetic movement is sort of much older than CCRU and Nick Land. It was really a Cold War ideology. that was built and sort of developed within, like, as I said, within the framework of the Cold War, and especially within, you know, the people who are really waging the Cold War. I'm thinking about the CIA and the sort of corporate partners that were putting the CIA up to commit the massive crimes that they committed during the Cold War. They were looking, as you say, for theory of control, how to control people and populations. And that theory of control ended up being called cybernetics, which posits that within a complex system with many different inputs, there are countervailing forces that cancel each other out and can create a stable complex system versus, you know, a disturbed complex system. And so then the goal to control the complex system then, which is the goal of these people, for example, to control the complex system of discourse around any one issue, is to be fully in control of both sides. So it's obvious how they're in control of the denialists, right? They directly are funding them, that work has been done. But they are also sort of directly in control of the scientists and environmentalists that have been the only people that have been available to counter the denialists. And they have been the only people available to counter the denialists, again, because of the Cold War. The wrong people, the bad guys, won the Cold War. I think that it's pretty clear that the communist government is much more able to, would be much more able to respond to the challenge of climate change, because you would need a centralized government to manage the transition off of fossil fuels onto clean energy. And that's why China is taking the lead and is basically humanity's only hope at this point. Back here in America, though, environmentalism, just as a circumstance of history, was developed in this sort of vacuum that was deprived of any socialist or Marxist theory, right? Anything that seems, by the time that the environmentalism got started, first with Rachel Carson in the 60s, and then later with James Lovelock and The Limits to Growth, within that milieu, you know, communism had already been radically eradicated from the United States culture and had been very declared off limits, right? So they were had to develop response to environmental degradation that was obvious to everybody. And it was obvious even to the corporate actors who were causing the environmental devastation, that there was going to be some pushback around that devastation, right? There was inevitably, people were going to respond to the degradation of the natural world in some way. So they, what they did is they proactively created an ideology based on cybernetic systems that allowed them to frame the debate about environmental debt. So while Rachel Carson started in the 60s with sort of what I would call a pollution narrative or a pollution framework, that we are releasing deadly toxins into the environment and we have to stop doing that, that made a lot of sense to people, and it resulted in the early environmental movement, which was the most successful of any, you know, there's been almost no success since then. That's when we got the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And then the cyberneticists really got control of environmentalism, and they did so very self-consciously and with a lot of funding, specifically from the Rockefeller Foundation, which set up cybernetic think tanks both here and in Europe that employed people who were interested in cybernetic theory. And that effort really resulted in the 1971 publication of the book The Limits to Growth, which I think has really defined what it means to be American environmentalist ever since. As it's in its title, it's not about pollution. It's about what are the limits beyond which we can't push the system, right? The system will accommodate change up to a certain limit. And beyond that, it's not said what actually happens beyond that. What actually happens according to their theories, right? What actually happens when those limits are exceeded is that the system becomes chaotic and undergoes sort of a radical chaotic period, after which it settles into a new equilibrium. they didn't want us to think about that chaotic period. They wanted us to understand nature as a stable, complex system that could accommodate abuse up to a certain level, right? And once that level, and once that idea of levels and limits has been established, then the rest of the discourse is around quibbling and quabbling. I don't think quabbling is a word. Quibbling over where that limit should be set. And you can keep doing that forever. And if you are a corporation that is has a huge lobbying apparatus, then it's easy to constantly lobby for that limit to be ever set higher and higher and higher. Actually, the limits to growth people seem to assume that we wouldn't exceed those limits, that we would somehow just stop because we reached a limit. In the absence of any real challenge from the actual real left, they built a discourse that occupies this whole region of our consciousness that is related to sort of the natural world or just being outside. They created a whole discourse that they control from both sides.
Jed, could you maybe help people understand how that discourse framing and controlled opposition could be useful in other contemporary problems, even, you know, looking at Russia or looking at China or looking at COVID? You know, there's always this, you know, the one and the two, and they can't kind of control both sides. So my other question is, who's the they without getting into, into a paranoia? And that's also why I was interested in that schizoid analysis.
Well, I'm the type of person who likes to think really like autistically deeply about one thing. But I think that once you're sensitized to this type of cybernetic control, you'll see it all over our political system. Most obviously in our electoral system, where we've got constant dialectic between Democrats and Republicans, even though we see that they're fundamentally the same and that there needs to be some sort of third option, we are held within this delicate balance where each election we're threatened with fascism and our only choice to counter fascism is to vote for neoliberal capitalism, which is actually a very close cousin of fascism, but very compatible with fascism. Who's the they is indeed an interesting and compelling question. For Marx, history is made by individual actors, but it is made within a set of conditions that are outside their control. But I think that there is a very sort of limited set of individual actors who are working for the self-interest in the interests of the logic of capital, right? The logic of accumulation. There are people out there who live their lives trying to increase the amount that's in, you know, that of wealth that they have, even though it is already so large as to be entirely abstract, right? Carl Icahn talks about money as just a point system and it's just purely a competitive game. And I think that those people are the people who have been highly motivated to take control of the they since the end of World War II. You know, World War II was a great confrontation between fascism and communism, and communism won. And that was a big threat to America because America was fundamentally a capitalist, you know, already a capitalist economy, and capitalism is inherently compatible with fascism, but not communism, right? And so it sees communism as its number one threat. So already during World War II, we had people like Alan Dulles who are treating Stalin as the enemy rather than Hitler, and we're making deals with the Germans, looking ahead to the very moment as soon as the armistice was reached in the war, America was, you know, predestined to pivot to being against the Soviet Union under the direction of whoever it was that was motivated solely by the accumulation of profit. And those people can often be found and named, but I wouldn't say that they're always obvious. And there can always be people who shirk the spotlight, actually exert a tremendous amount of power. So I wouldn't limit it to saying like, oh, it's just the CIA, it's just the intelligence apparatus, or it's just Wall Street. It's all of those combined and more.
Jed, one of my questions I would have just to counter a bit. Why don't you see communism as one of the hyper objects that's just controlling it's, to me, it seems similar, in just like the sentient oil or capitalism, that it's taking possession of the human mind and its project.
Well, it allows humans to control the economy, right? It puts humans back in the driver's seat to think about what we want our work, what ends we want our work to achieve. And so it takes away this sort of inhuman imperative that profit creates, where profit supersedes any humanistic values, and instead says, no, we are going to create an institution that is more powerful than the profit motive, and that is under the power, that is under the control, and we're going to call that institution, you know, the government or the dictatorship of the proletariat. And sure, it might be a hyper object in the sense that a hyper object is actually a value neutral term that just means an object that is bigger than an object that you can touch, but it actually places human beings at the top of the economy in a very practical and hands-on way.
But every time, I'm kind of neutral, but, you know, going to Cambodia or something, you know, every time, or North Korea, you're never going to see the communistic system really, maybe in utopic mindset, it's controlled by the people, but the same problems happen. There's an elite force that takes control of the hyper object.
Well, there's a vanguard force. There's people who are actually in control of the government, right? So you will get figureheads, Kim Il-jong or whatever. But, you know, when you're looking at actually existing communist countries, you have to look at it within the context of the sort of long Cold War, where they're always operating in a hostile environment against United States that is working actively all the time to undermine them. And yet, despite that, they have achieved great things. I think if you look at Cuba, you see a really inspiring example, just, you know, so close to us. They've been able to resist American imperialism for so long, and they've been able to create such an amazing educational system, amazing healthcare system. And I think, you know, likewise, China is obviously a much more complex and big example than Cuba. But I think that, you know, in recent years, we've seen Xi Jinping, sorry, my Chinese pronunciation isn't excellent. We've seen him going back towards a firmer state control of the economy. And as that's been happening, we've seen them lift everybody in their country, billions of people out of it, and create an economy that where there's housing for everybody, healthcare for everybody. And so I think that in actually existing communist countries, yes, there are critiques to be made, and always critiques to be made against the specific leaders. But just because they're leaders doesn't necessarily mean that they don't represent the will of the people. So,
well, let's go to a specific example that I think can link back to your oil thesis. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Venezuela, which is totally a, you know, narco petro state. And I'm just curious how you see, maybe if there's a thesis of petroleum just fully taking over the mindset and the hyper object of, you know, people or the government, or and how that can fit into understanding, you know, some of the petro, I think you call it petro historical analysis. I forget the term you use.
Yeah. Yeah. I have yet to fully dive into Venezuela, you know, as an example, but that's, you know, one of the many examples government basically, you know, created, insisted upon a state-owned oil company, and greatly pissed off the United States by exerting control over its own oil reserves, which is a good thing. I think that all of the complexity of what happened under Chavez has to be taken in that context of a constant and undermining an antagonism from the United States, right? So that they weren't operating in an environment where they could realize, you know, their greatest ideals. But at the same time, you know, they were able to redirect a chunk of the wealth that came from their natural resources back to the people. And insofar as they were able to do that, I think it was successful. But it requires, again, going up sort of head on against the forces that don't want that to happen.
I don't know. I think I grew up in South America, and every Venezuelan I know would have a different analysis, I think, of what happened and some of the framework. I actually think it's maybe ties into your concept of oil just kind of polluting everything. It becomes a one source, comparing it to Norway that has, you know, a pretty well-managed oil economy. It's just interesting how oil can, it's different historical analysis, but I'm really interested in the concept of how the hyper object can totally possess people, either being capitalism, petroleum. You know, it's an interesting framework to understand how, you know, large groups of people are controlled or not controlled, or just the ego of movements happen.
Yeah, exactly. It is a really interesting framing that I think people naturally grasp, you know. It's like kind of like, you know, John Carpenter's The Thing, or, you know, the oil in X-Files that Recluse was talking about, that there are these cultural touch points for this idea of this thing that can take over humans and present it and sort of wear our mask, but make us do its bidding. And I think that that is actually a good way to think about petrocapitalism, the sort of the forces that control us to our own destruction. Right?
Jumping from the politics, maybe we can do a little bit of your work from a religious analysis. You have some, I think that's really interesting for people to really kind of stretch their mind on how, you know, walk me through your concept of the jinn, some of the Middle Eastern concepts regarding petroleum and how they fit into the popular culture.
Definitely. So I take my inspiration, of course, again, from Cyclonopedia, which uses sort of a network of different ideas from pre-Islamic, Middle Eastern in the broad sense, I guess, including Eastern, traditions, right? So he talks about, for example, the Zoroastrian figure of Druze Nasu. Nasu means court, or it means body. Druze is the demoness or the goddess that takes over a body upon the moment of its death, and therefore begins the process of decomposition, right? She is the force of decomposition, not personified, but placed, given an identity. So that is very useful for thinking about oil as the end product of the decomposition and rot of just vast, vast amounts of biomatter, right? It is the end state of decomposition. And so that figure of Druze as a demoness is very apt and sort of well used by Nagarastani to talk about oil. He also talks about the Sanskrit word avatar and avatara. You know, in Sanskrit, the A is sort of implied, which means to descend or a descended being. Usually in Hinduism, think about a being that's descended from heaven to the mortal realm. Vishnu taking incarnation, taking avatara as Krishna or any of his other 11 avatars. But if you take that notion of descent as a vector for existence, you can also see how oil is a descended being from physical life here, right? So it's life, embodied life, sort of taken reincarnation in a lower realm. And so I think that idea is very fruitful. And then there's lots of other sort of pre-Islamic, Assyrian, notions in Cyclonopedia, all of which are really interesting and good. But as I said earlier, you know, Nagarastani was working in a context where he was sort of, living in opposition to Islamist theocracy. And so I think he was very interested in looking at Islam in its political context, in its complicity in various ways in creating war in the Middle East. But I don't think he was interested in its potential to describe the world spiritually. But I'm very taken with the idea of jinn. Jinn are, it's not a minority or fringe view. All Muslims believe literally in jinn because they're mentioned in the Quran. And we know that our Muslim brothers and sisters are uniquely good at faith and having faith. And so their faith in jinn is unquestionable. And many people have posited that jinn are really the explanation behind almost all sort of paranormal phenomena that people talk about all the time, whether it's cryptids, aliens, whenever, you know, leprechauns, all of those things can sort of be explained by jinn, who are beings that live here in the middle realm or in Earth with us. So they occupy the same space, but they're invisible to us. Jinn are to, as humans are to the Earth that is made out of the Earth in some sense, jinn are to fire. Jinn are said to be beings of smokeless fire. They are very numerous, and they also have free will. So there are all kinds of jinns out there. There are Muslim jinn. There are jinn who are working for, you know, the furtherment of humanity and are very benevolent. We've got trickster jinn, et cetera, et cetera. And so I see a particular type of jinn, if you will, as being dissolved in oil, you know, since they are beings of fire, and jinn can choose to make themselves visible in the material realm sort of at will and at whim. Jinn, I consider to be that thing that sits between the atoms in the hydrocarbon molecule where the energy is, right? In chemistry, the energy of a molecule sits in the bonds between the atoms, and they can either have high energy bonds or low energy bonds. And so that I consider that unit, that spark of energy to be a jinn. And I was reading in a very excellent book, Not of the Soul by Stephanie Pandolfo, she sort of brings to light the voice of a figure that she calls the imam, who's a sort of real but anonymous imam who works in Morocco, who is talking about insanity and mental health, again bringing it back to these ideas of schizophrenia. For the Quranic Islamic treatment of mental health and insanity, that is viewed as a sort of possession or infestation by a jinn. That's a really long tradition in Islam. And for this imam, who's making a differentiation, you know, just very much as we were talking about oil or capitalism sort of possessing humanity, the same could be said for jinn, who possess people who have mental illnesses. And so for this imam who practices Quranic medicine, and he identifies two different types of disease caused by jinn. The first is where people are actively possessed by jinn, in that same way as, you know, the black oil in the X-Files. And those are the psychotic disorders where you lose touch with your human reality. So your schizophrenia, schizoaffective psychosis. But then there's another mental illness that is caused by jinn, but is caused by jinn who fuel a machine driven by fire. And he says specifically fueled by benzene. Benzene, of course, shares a root with the benzene. Word benzene. Yeah, exactly. But it sort of applies specifically to petrochemicals. It's different than the word used for fuel in the Quran. And so I think it was when I saw him and I saw that the author had, you know, put in parentheses that he used the word benzene, struck me that this is what he was talking about. He's talking about mental illness caused by the machine that is fueled by oil. And so these are your mood disorders, your depressions, anxieties that we identify with modern industrialized life, and that emanates sort of from this basically Western that feeds on oil. And so that's why I sort of use the term benzenol jinn to refer to them as jinn who are dissolved in oil.
So Jed, your analysis is quite literal then, that you actually believe that these forces are jinn or demonic type possessions are actually influencing individual state people, and then you actually hyper objectize it to forces that are controlling populations or people or in general society, correct?
Yeah, right, exactly. Like it is quite literal in the sense that it's materialistic. Yeah, like if the oil from the X-Files, I don't know if you're familiar with it, I'm like barely familiar with it, but if the black oil from the X-Files, which sort of occupies humanity, like a human, and bends it to their will, if it had the power, if it really spread through all of us, you know, how would it organize society?
Well, what I think is so interesting for listeners who aren't viewing it from a religious framework, I would recommend they think about hyperstition, just ideas themselves being possessing qualities that can really aggravate or control society, going back to capitalism or communism or even a religious movement like in Tehran or in Iran, right?
Right, exactly. Exactly, yeah. If any of your listeners get uncomfortable with these ideas, remember that speculative element and just put a what if in front of everything. And then allow your mind to you know, entertain these possibilities.
It's so funny, Jed, because I have a friend who's a psychiatrist and he was an atheist for, you know, University of Chicago trained, super atheist, rationalist, materialist, and 10 years of forensic psychology and psychiatry. He's definitely a religious, he converted to Catholicism and believes in demonic possession. And, you know, he keeps it quite private, but, you know, he sent me, you know, the medical director of Columbia University is a hardcore former Jew who converted to Catholicism as well because of the culture of exorcism and demonic analysis. And it's interesting talking about your Quranic medical practitioner. So there's definitely history. And I wanted to jump maybe to a different religion, Shintoism, and concepts of animism and how that might fit into panpsychism or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, I'm not super familiar with Shintoism, but I am very familiar with Hinduism, which I guess I would consider, if Shintoism is like a branch of Buddhism, then I would say Buddhism is a branch of Hinduism. So I feel justified talking about Hinduism and in response to that question, if that's okay.
Yeah,
so
that's fine. I think
that way I'm not looking outside expertise.
Yeah, I would just add that Shintoism is more not a branch of Buddhism, more just a folkloric kind of animistic religion philosophy where they see every object, a rock, a tree having a ki and energy. So I think it's similar to maybe Hinduistic type beliefs as well.
Yeah, yeah. These beliefs are extremely common all around the world in traditional beliefs and practices. They're, you know, it's not universal, but extremely, extremely common that you will see people worshiping the spirit of a place, that believing that, or, you know, aspect of a place like a river. In Hinduism, that we worship the river Ganga, which in an extremely literal way, you know, receives our worship and is aware of us worshiping it. In the same way that the concept of darshan, we go in front of an idol of the goddess and we look in her eyes and we believe that she can see us back because she is literally in the rock of the idol, because she is literally in everything. And, you know, going back to your psychiatrist friend, I think that his arc really mirrors the arc of scientism in general. My sister is actually like a subatomic physicist. And the more that, you know, those realms are studied, the less mechanistic they look, right? The less that mechanistic determinism has explanatory power, the more sophisticated that science gets. And so there becomes room sort of in the void between the parts of the atom, you know, the void that it is between the protons and the electrons is vastly huger than the electrons themselves. And it's in that void that we can start to see perhaps the roots of consciousness or of your spiritual, however you want to project your spiritual ideals, right?
Jed, you said we kept using the word we. Are you a believer in Hinduism, or what is your spiritual practice?
Yeah, I'm a believer in Hinduism. You know, you can't convert to Hinduism because it's a radically open religion. But I spent two very formative years of my life in India, living both in Varanasi and in Calcutta, and traveling around and studying with one in particular mentor. And so I find it to be definitely the most intellectually fruitful tradition to work in.
And how has that conversion helped you understand? Has that opened you towards these concepts of like the jinn? And how do you fit this all in?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, it's all of a piece, right? One thing about Hinduism that is being overshadowed by the fundamentalism that's taking over the religion right now, which is very terrible, the one thing about Hinduism is it's that it believes in everybody's belief. It believes that everybody's right. We're all taking different paths up the same mountain. And so it's broad enough and open enough to incorporate elements from anything and to allow the incorporation of elements from anything.
You know, jumping back to concepts from Nick Land, I think many believers in that kind of accelerationism and those type of concepts eventually find religion as well. Either you're coming from the left or the right. I'm just curious if you see any, you know, as society kind of fragments, do you see a return to religion, or do you see kind of these egregores trying to hold us in a place? Or
I don't know. I think I do. I think that there's the scientistic ideology is still both very prevalent and extremely useful to those in power. And, you know, when I talk about that, I'm not talking about like actual scientists like researching the nature of reality and real things, but I'm talking about, you know, this I believe in science mentality. I don't see that going away anytime soon, just the same way that I don't see any, you know, anti-capitalist revolution happening anytime soon.
Maybe at the end of one of your essays, you talk about what you'd like to fight, or I guess an option against the mineral consciousness, the sentient oil. How do you think humans can return that humanism? Why should they return that humanism? Why aren't you going down a kind of accelerationist Marxist view that the faster we accelerate through capitalism, we'll get to some other utopic thinking?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that the idea that Marx believes that, you know, utopian communism is inevitable is a bit of an artifact of, you know, the Communist Manifesto, which he was saying that in the same way that you say, like, you know, in a protest, you're out there on the street protesting, you know, for environmental controls, and you get out there and you say, we will win, we are winning. It doesn't necessarily mean that when you go back home, you think that it's inevitable that you will win the thing that you were protesting, right? So I think that that's a bit of a misconception about Marxism. Communism generally does present a way to reassert control over the means of production, over our working lives, over and therefore over the economy. And so that's what I feel needs to happen. Now, do I think it is going to happen? No, I don't see it happening. Like I said, the wrong people won the Cold War, but they won it decisively. And they won it through deeply immoral means, right? It's going to be really hard to come back from that. But that doesn't stop us from thinking about this, what communism could do. And so I posit that, you know, within a larger communist revolution, there has to be petro-communist strain in which it is recognized that oil as a material is a means of production and therefore needs to be seized by the state. So in my ideal utopian state that is reacting to the reality of climate change as it exists now, all oil will be owned by the state, and then companies can move it around, can refine it, etc. But it can only be bought and sold by the state. This will allow the state to allocate it to where it's needed the most. You know, the most common argument for like against climate change action, shall we say, like the most common argument by people who are, for whatever reason, being paid by oil companies to advocate for more fossil fuel use, is this idea that, you know, the whole world is in energy poverty and we need to expand the use of oil, coal, and gas to bring development and electricity to these underserved populations. Well, petro-communism will say, okay, then we will allocate the necessary oil for that human development to take place, to lift those people out of poverty if that's necessary. And then the rest of you guys who are already bourgeois, first world, very comfortable, you're going to have to live without energy because we just don't have, we have a huge amount of oil left in the ground, but we don't have any more quote unquote carbon budget. We don't have any very much room to put more carbon into the atmosphere without facing disaster. We're already facing the disaster. It's already too late. That's a bit of a different question. And so
back to your point about the limit, the controlled discourse or whatnot. Why don't you reject both the left and the right paradigm and go with a kind of a decentralized, more human approach, like a more individualized?
I don't believe that centrism is a coherent ideology. I don't believe that. I think that most like sort of third way type centrist talk is a cover for capital to keep operating. That's just been where I come from forever.
Oh, no, it's just interesting to see how we can use some of those ideas to just, to me, it keeps coming the hyper object controlling the individual's free will or of choice and how you can escape those quote bonds.
But a centralized economy that can be controlled and designed is again reasserting free will over our economy. So I don't see any way that there's like, I think that most of the sort of accelerationist ideas that are neither communist nor fascist, I think that they actually are quite fascist and have like a callous disregard for human life and well-being.
And then, Jed, maybe we can just kind of conclude on what do you think, I mean, regardless of the politics, and I think it's a very, how can people use these skills just to improve their daily life, to try to understand, I think, one, the discourse, and very useful for people who get caught up in the left, right, Republican, Democrat, you know, anything they can take from this.
Yeah. Well, I think you should get noided. I don't know if you're familiar with the term noided, but there is.
I don't know that. What's that?
There's a growing sort of underclass of us on the internet who are rereading history with a paranoid sensibility, a parapolitical sensibility. And so I would just encourage people to go, you know, get educated, listen to podcasts like Subliminal Jihad and Program to Chill, read writers like Peter Dale Scott, Dave McGowan, and all of whom, like, I think that the careful study of history will help people understand on a deeper level what's going on today, right? Like, that's not a very radical belief, but learning that, you know, history hasn't been told to us straight up.
Well, that's why I came back to the, you know, schizophrenic. I think it's like Robert Anton Wilson, even if you go back to some of his writing, it's all kind of, you know, Philip K. Dick required, you know, framework to really understand kind of the fragmentation of reality and then the forces that are actually fragmenting that reality in real time. The last question I have, could you tell me a little bit about your interest in Gravity's Rainbow and Thomas Pynchon and what attracts you there and any parallels to your other work?
Well, it's deeply compatible and parallel with all of this, right? Like, I think that it was definitely Gravity's Rainbow that sent me down this path. I think that Pynchon is obsessed with oil and energy and technology and these questions of paranoid control. He is a writer where if you spend the time, for example, to track down his references, then you will get a parapolitical education just based on you know, the references to real things that you find in his books. He was an incredibly noited writer. He's technically not dead, but I don't think he'll publish anything else in his life. And he's also just, I think, you know, clearly the most talented writer, just in terms of funny, like things that are hilariously funny, beautiful descriptions, people's interiority, and like I said, a keen understanding and critique of these hidden powers that we've been talking about that control our lives. And it requires the effort of reading a book like Gravity's Rainbow to truly internalize this worldview, right? To turn it from something that you think about intellectually into something that sort of infects your everyday life. And so, I think that people should, if they're looking to get noited, I think Gravity's Rainbow would be a great place to start.
And then last on the concept of kind of paranoia for me, you have these graphics that you put with your essays that are AI. I believe you're using Midjourney, or I don't know what software you're using. What do you think about those drawings? What's your aesthetic behind them? They have kind of that schizophrenic, unreal feel, darkness. And what are those about?
Yeah. Well, I mean, AI is obviously a very powerful tool, and what it's powerful at specifically is translating words into visual art, right? And so as a writer on the internet, if you are a writer on the internet, you have to put an image with every article, right? That's like, that's just like, you know, basic SEO practice, and it makes your stuff more appealing. And so when AI came along, you know, I'm not thrilled about it, obviously, for all of the reasons that I think we've sort of established. But it is a tool that allows me to convert words into image. The words that I like are crazy and schizophrenic. And especially with those earlier models that were coming out maybe like a year or two ago, if you put in, you know, a sentence from Cyclonopedia that's really abstract and, you know, has really compelling words in it, then I found that it could make these like really cool kind of like psychedelic ass looking pictures. And I was like, sweet, this solves my image problem. Since then, I've sort of like used it to create a more coherent aesthetic by using the same like root pictures to generate each new image, which I wanted to do because all of the things on my Substack are really elements in this larger project about oil that will eventually be a book. And so I did want some visual cohesion. And so AI was able to give that to me. It's just a new tool to use.
And then, Jed, as you play around with these forces, are you concerned about being possessed, or are you possessed, and counter those energies or whatnot?
Well, I am certainly possessed, but in the sense that I'm subject to the same logic of capitalism that everybody else is. And I also, like, you know, radically dependent on oil and technology, not willing to give those things up and go live in the woods. So, yeah, like, I think the only context in which I would be willing to give those things up and go live in the woods is if there's a collective movement to do so, because only if we all do it, do I think that there will be actual change. And so, yeah, I'm certainly writing from the belly of the beast.
And then, Jed, what's the status of your book, or where can people find your writing and whatnot?
Yeah, people can check me out at thespouter.substack.com. The book, since I work in publishing, like, I would usually just self-publish it, but since I work in publishing, I recognize that it's really not the same. Like, in music, it's sort of the same to put your stuff on Spotify and not sign with a major label, right? But it's not that way in books yet. So what I'm trying to do is generate a big enough audience that I can attract the interest of a literary agent who's purely, like all of us, motivated by the profit motive. So I wouldn't even be posting if I wasn't interested in that kind of, if I didn't have that obligation to sort of get published in a way that has a print run and an Ingram listing so that it's available in bookstores. So that hasn't happened in any way yet. And so people will have to wait a long time for the book. But if you do the paid subscription on my Substack, then whenever the hell the book comes out, which could very well take 5 years from now, then I'll send you a copy. So it's a way of pre-ordering it. You know, it will exist if I have to self-publish, and it will. You'll get your copy, but it could take, you know, 5 or 10 years.
And then, Jed, my last question is, how do you, on your daily normal life, do you think about these concepts, or how do you interact with like your mom or someone who, I'm just curious, how do you express these concepts to just what I quote normie type people or non-philosophical people?
Yeah, no, I don't. This is stuff that is, you know, my personal time alone with my typewriter. You know, I have a very intelligent and engaged family, and they understand and support. Well, my son certainly doesn't understand. My wife understands what I'm doing here and supports it, but like, it doesn't make up the texture of my life. It's cool. A side project.
Yeah, that's great. I think anything else you want people to take away, Jed, or just...
No, just, you know, thank you. This was like a really interesting and engaging conversation. I really appreciate the opportunity to do it. Thank you to everybody who's listening.
Jed, thank you very much for your time. And I appreciate your project. I think I would definitely be more on the right than you, but mm-hmm. I really appreciate challenging my own conceptions of, I think the materialism of Marx is the best way to look at history.
Yeah.
So I think it's just unparalleled, regardless of where you are politically. I mean, that's really... understanding the forces of material objects and how they drive people. So I think that's an important
Totally. You know, the strength of Marx is analyzing what actually exists in capitalism, not speculating about like how we change it. But the power that he brings is the analytic frame.
What I want people to take away, you know, regardless of the concepts of Jin and Santiago, it's just think about reality in this other way that might help you or not.
You know? Exactly.
Right? So, okay, Jed, have a wonderful day and we'll talk soon.
Thanks. Great? You too.